Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 12th of May. Mental Floss Magazine, which is really an entertaining, fun magazine, has their annual 10 issue, which is out right now. It's their May-June issue, and they're putting the spotlight on all kinds of things. 10 things your body can do after you die. 10 modern-day independence movements. You'll be interested to find out where some of those are taking place. And, well, I'll give you a little hint. One of them happens to be Alaska, of all places. 10 not-so-bright ideas in science. 10 U.S. vice presidents who have some interesting backgrounds. 10 rock ballads. And a number of other tens, their annual 10 issue. And Will Pearson is our guest this hour. He is co-founder and editor of Mental Floss Magazine. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. Send an email. That's at talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hi, Will.
Good morning, Kathleen. How
Hi.
Are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good. How in the world do you come up with such an eclectic list? This is not your usual 10 list, is it?
That's right. Yeah, we had a lot of fun with this issue. You know, as our readership has grown, part of the benefit of that has been getting some great ideas from our readers. So before we tackle an issue, we'll ask our readers for ideas or things that they want to be learning. And then we have such a terrific time compiling those lists and working with our researchers to put together an issue.
Yeah. Let's start with the vice presidents because we were just spending the last hour talking about the presidency. Henry Wallace, I had no idea he was a dedicated devotee of Eastern mysticism. That's a story.
Yeah, that's part of the fun and not exactly something you read about.
Right, no.
When, you know, looking in your textbooks from childhood, But yeah, you know, pretty interesting guy looking back again, as you mentioned, known for being a follower of Eastern mysticism. When he was Secretary of Agriculture, he actually sent his guru out to Mongolia to hunt for evidence that Christ had visited Asia.
Now, oh my gosh.
Sent him over there under some, you know, other guys, but it was an interesting fact to learn that. And all the other facts about him, the fact that he was a Soviet apologist for quite some time after having traveled to the Soviet Union, and of course, killed his reputation and was defeated in his own run for the presidency in 1948. So it was definitely interesting to learn about these guys.
Why did Roosevelt pick him?
You know, I think he thought he would have been just kind of a safe pick, that, you know, somebody that that may not have been, you know, gotten too much attention, wouldn't have been thrown off for any other reason. But the Democratic Party was not a big fan of Wallace's, even from the beginning. But Roosevelt made it clear that he would not run without him, so the party agreed.
Hmm. Chester Arthur, who exited the White House a hero, didn't quite enter that way. What was his story?
No, he certainly didn't. And if you were going to have a ranking of the most corrupt vice presidents, at least in their history, he would probably have been way up there. He'd been involved in a well-known political machine and held one of the most lucrative positions in government, which was the collector for the Port of New York. And so for quite a long time, he was making about $40,000 a year. Well, in the 1880s, that you're talking about what may be about $700,000 a year at that point, and ran a spoils system for a number of other employees. But interestingly, he repaired that reputation as James Garfield's vice president, because he cleaned up his reputation by signing the Pendleton Civil Service Act, which attempted to put a stop to the kind of patronage that had made him rich in the first place.
Hmm. William Rufus Devane King, Buchanan's vice president. Was Buchanan gay?
Well, that's what we, you know, I guess we can't know for sure. But what we do know is that neither of them, neither King nor Buchanan, had married and lived together for about 15 years before Buchanan became president. And King had a number of nicknames, one of them given by Andrew Jackson, often referred to him as Miss Nancy. So it was, you know, it's one of those things that you read about these guys and read some of these facts and you think, this is the interesting stuff that we should have been reading in the textbooks. And, you know, here is a vice president. Again, King was the first vice president to take the oath on foreign soil. He'd gone over there to recover from tuberculosis and alcoholism it didn't work, unfortunately, and he died only 25 days into office.
Oh, my. But was it a big deal that he was gay or not?
Well, it wasn't something that was widely known, of course, at that point. I mean, among other politicians, they certainly had these reputations, but had he openly come out and said he was gay, I think, of course, it would have been a much bigger deal.
Yeah. Obviously, the one that we remember because of what he did was Aaron Burr.
That's true. Of course, you know, for shooting and killing Alexander Hamilton in their 1804 duel. But I don't think people realize the extent of some of his plans. You hear a little bit about some of his treasonous conspiracies to become emperor of the Western U.S. and Mexico. His plan was uncovered, and so he was tried for treason but found not guilty because he had not committed the treason yet. And so you think, well, maybe that's the end of it. That was the end of what was in the textbook that I had read. But then you realize he set his sights on Florida and actually tried to convince Napoleon to help him conquer it, but was unsuccessful there as well.
So, oh my gosh.
He was always up to something.
I guess so. Isn't it weird that there were duels, for heaven's sake?
It's very difficult to imagine. Yeah, we see duels, I guess, these days, but usually not involving guns. So I don't know which is more painful, the duels we see in today's politics or just going ahead and getting it over with like these guys did.
Yeah. Boy, you couldn't have two more contrasting figures here. Abraham Lincoln's Vice President Andrew Johnson, you describe as a drunk. He took the oath drunk as a skunk and belligerent as hell.
That's right, yeah, yeah. And, he had grown up poor, and he always felt the aristocracy in Washington had abused his kinfolk. And so he reminded people in Washington of this constantly and reminded them that they owed their jobs to plebeians such as himself. But there was a great quote from the New York World at that time that said, nobody had respect for the guy. And it said, to think that one frail life stands between this insolent, clownish creature and the presidency.
Mm.
God bless and spare Abraham Lincoln. Well, of course, he didn't. And unfortunately, Andrew Johnson ended up in office.
And had to handle Reconstruction.
He did, and didn't exactly do a great job. So
right.
he avoided being booted out of office by just one vote after the impeachment.
Here's one of our favorite guys, Spiro Agnew.
That's right. Yeah, and it was fun, going back and seeing the differences from even the earliest vice presidents to some in more recent times. But, much of the country loved him for his stance during Vietnam. He gave a number of speeches. They were relatively divisive speeches, but he was attacking the peaceniks and seen by many of those people as a true patriot at the time, and was also relatively unsullied by the Watergate scandal. But then was investigated and had a problem of his own for extortion and bribery. And despite telling many crowds in his speaking engagements that he would not resign if indicted, he, of course, did as part of a plea bargain just a few weeks later.
Right. Nelson Rockefeller.
Nelson Rockefeller, not a poor guy, comparing him
right.
to Andrew Johnson, obviously, on the contrast, a much, much wealthier guy. He was one of those, he was very hard-headed, and when he decided something wasn't done right, he was going to have it changed. And it was in 1933 he had commissioned Mexican artist Diego Rivera to paint a large-scale mural in the lobby of the RCA building at Rockefeller Center. Well, the mural didn't exactly please him because there was a likeness of Vladimir Lenin in there and an overt reference to communism, and he was offended by this. And so he asked Rivera to change it. And when he refused to do this, Rockefeller had the whole mural torn down and carted out in pieces. So he definitely wasn't going to stand for this.
Oh, my. Let's move on. We'll go back to see if people want to talk about more vice presidents. Some of these are just extraordinary. 10 not-so-bright ideas in science. This one, though, is really interesting. The gay bomb. Nuke your enemies. Why nuke them when you can make them fall in love? I like this idea.
That's right. The idea of the gay bomb is to make the enemy, too distracted by their libidos to fight back. And so, you would use certain chemicals that would lure those, to the enemy lines and try to make them gay all of a sudden in order to distract them from what they're trying to do.
Is somebody actually working on that?
It has been worked on for some time now, and that's part of the amusement and reading about so many of these things is that these are very real experiments.
Yeah. This one, though, I'm sorry. Farmers in Japan found a purpose for their surplus cow dung.
Mm-hmm. By applying heat and pressure to the excrement, one of the scientists was able to produce vanilla flavoring. So could be used in some of our foods, or I suppose in some of our ice creams in one way or another. Yeah, I would agree with you. That's a pretty unfortunate finding there.
Yeah. Why does linen wrinkle?
Why does linen wrinkle? I apologize. I actually don't have, you know, if Newton hadn't discovered gravity, then mathematician and physicist Enrique Cerda Villablanca might have never discovered why linen wrinkles. And so in a series of papers, one called Wrinkling of an Elastic Sheet Under Tension, he came up with the general theory that wrinkling that accounts for fabric stiffness, reactions to stretching and pulling, and the wavelength of resulting wrinkles. And so the duo claims their work has applications beyond the dry cleaner and believes it may change the way clothes are designed. It's pretty funny. You know, you think of these scientists working on huge experiments that are going to change the world, and then you realize some of these are much more amusing to read about, aren't quite as magnificent or quite as huge.
Yeah, like the one about the problems that some sword swallowers might have.
That's very true. That's just one of the discoveries of a radiologist in Great Britain. After interviewing 47 practitioners, and I didn't know you could find 47 in the world still today, they found that sword swallowers seldom go to hospitals. However, 16 admitted that they'd had surgery at some point.
Ugh.
And one gentleman confessed to having had a bread knife removed from his stomach. How someone gets into this practice is probably what amazes me the most. I can't imagine that first experiment with trying to swallow a sword.
I was just thinking that. What in the world would motivate anybody to want to be a sword swallower? I just
I'm with you on that.
Can't get it. Some of these independence movements are things that you would never think about. What's the matter? Alaska doesn't like us?
Well, you know, there has been a growing independence movement there for some time, and people may be surprised. It doesn't have a huge following, but twice in its history, about 5% of the population there has decided that they did want to become a separate nation. It goes back to 1958, when Alaska citizens were given a simple yes or no vote on statehood. And, you know, a few of them decided that they did want to create their own state. Well, there was a land developer there named Joe Vogler who decided to, you know, organize these revotes to try to really push this and help create the Alaskan Independence Party. And, you know, they continue even today to draw about 4% of voters statewide. So it's interesting to realize that that's there. It's not something you hear about, but, you know, one out of 20 people is not insignificant.
No, it's not. It's worth a talk show, don't you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll be right on the case. Vermont also.
Vermont as well. Yeah, the second Vermont Republic wants the state to, return its independence. Of course, many of the principles there focus on things like equality, green energy, sustainable agriculture, and strong local government. And one poll estimates that about 13% of the populace there supports the idea. Now, it was interesting when we were working on this story for this issue, the primaries there were going on in Vermont, and we saw that in March of 2008, two Vermont towns voted to arrest President Bush and Vice President Cheney should they ever show their faces there. And I don't know how successful they would be in that attempt, but it was actually voted on by a majority there.
Isn't that something? Who lives in that area? I mean, who are these people? Yeah. What are the demos?
It would be interesting to see the demographics there. I actually don't know them off the top of head, but I think you can get somewhat of an idea about the people, that have grown up there and that have, there for many generations, focusing again on that idea of green energy, sustainable agriculture. I think it's very much kind of a separatist idea there.
Yeah. Sort of those elitist liberals, right?
Right. I guess.
Elitist liberal tree huggers or whatever we might call them. Gibraltar, there isn't much there, is there?
No, there's really not much there at all. And, the truth is there's not a lot of conflict there. You know, you're only talking about a 2.5 square mile island, and it's owned by Great Britain and has been owned since 1713 in a treaty with Spain. But there's a catch to the situation because Britain would love to grant them independence. But according to the treaty, Spain gets the territory should Britain ever relinquish it.
Oh.
And the people of Gibraltar don't want that at all. Back in 1967, the citizens of Gibraltar voted on which country they'd rather belong to, and overwhelmingly, 96% of the voter turnout, preferred Great Britain. And so Spain didn't take kindly to this decision and closed its border with Gibraltar, cutting it off from Europe by land for about 16 years. So talks have continued, though, and in 2007, a new constitution gave Gibraltar greater autonomy. And so we'll see what happens there, but it's definitely not a a place of serious conflict.
Yeah. The Easter Island.
Easter Island is one of those that has been very different, though, because under the control of Chile, and even though it is perhaps the most geographically isolated spot on Earth, it still has had quite a bit of control placed on it by Chile, you know, from 2,300 miles away. It was back in 1888 that Chile annexed the island, and before long, the Chilean government had turned much of the land over to sheep herders and relocated many of the Rapa Nui people there. And then Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet, you know, basically made the Polynesian language illegal. And so they've faced a number of problems from the government there. And Chile is still ruling supreme from two time zones away, even though there have been a number of attempts to gain independence for Easter Island.
Mm. Would you like to go there?
I would love to visit, yes. I would definitely love to visit just to see it.
Yeah. You talk about considering Aruba's laid-back image. It's fitting that the island's march toward independence has been more of a stroll. Has it been going on a long time?
Exactly.
Yeah.
From the Netherlands, you know, they Aruba began to distinguish itself from the rest of the Netherlands back in the 1940s or so. Came up with their own national anthem and a flag, and the Netherlands actually granted independence to them. The problem is that Aruba would be cut off from Dutch funding within 10 years of that. So that would have been back in the 80s. Well, you know, as the deadline approached, the island's economic reality and lack of natural resources quickly dawned on the Aruban leadership, and so they actually came crawling back, you might say, to postpone this independence. So for now, the islands continue to hold the same complicated status as they did a couple of decades ago.
Hmm. Will Pearson is our guest this hour. Will is the co-founder and editor of Metal Floss Magazine, which is a highly entertaining, wonderful magazine to read when you, you know, you're looking for interesting bits of historical information, fun things, and very well researched. It's their 10-issue, 10 ideas to make you feel smart again. This magazine is where knowledge junkies can get their fix. Included in this, 10 American sports heroes you won't find on a Wheaties box, 10 things your body can do after you die, 10 modern-day independence movements, architectural masterpieces of tomorrow, 10 ruthless rock managers, 10 not-so-bright ideas in science. We've talked about some of these areas. 10 U.S. vice presidents. Feel free to join in the conversation and add to the list that we already have, or make your own 10 list. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee line is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. That address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Before we start taking your phone calls, John Treader is our phone answerer here, wonderful volunteer. He'll be chatting with you, and we'll get you on the air. You know, you may want to start with vice presidents. There may be others. We didn't go through all of them, those who are notable for one reason or another. Ira Flatow, we want to let you know, the host of Talk of the Nation Science Friday, is coming to Milwaukee May 16 for a live national broadcast of his program. And you're invited to join us at the Milwaukee Public Museum May 16 from 1 to 3 p.m. for the show, and also to stay for a reception to meet Ira Flatow and members of the Science Friday team. Those tickets are $20, and they include admission to the museum, the radio broadcast, and also a reception with refreshments. Later that day, there will be a VIP dinner at Mater's German Restaurant in downtown Milwaukee. Ira Flatow will be there. I'll be there, Joy Cardine and Ben Marins. And tickets for the buffet dinner are $50 each. On Tuesday, May 15, we're teaming up with the Discovery World Museum for their family night activities, including museum tours, special demonstrations, and movies. And the highlight will be a presentation given by Ira Flatow entitled Catalysts of Creativity, from movie stars to Michael Jackson. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for children up to 17 years. Information about all three events plus how to receive a souvenir T-shirt is on our website, and that's WPR.org, WPR.org, and then just click on the picture of Ira Flatow. For tickets, 414-227-2047, 414-227-2047, and we hope to see you at some of these, what should be very, very fun events. Join this conversation if you'd like. Mental Floss's annual 10 issue is out, the place where knowledge junkies get their fix. Will Pearson, co-founder and editor of Mental Floss magazine, is our guest, and our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're joining us in Milwaukee. After a very brief pause, we will go to 10 architectural masterpieces of tomorrow. They haven't been built yet, but they have captured the attention of the people at Mental Floss. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Will Pearson, co-founder and editor of Mental Floss magazine, and we are talking about their annual 10 issue, which includes, we'll get to that in a moment here, the next 10 wonders of the world, 10 not-so-bright ideas in science, 10 sports heroes neglected by Wheaties, 10 vice presidents actually worth noting, 10 things your body can do after you die. You also may want to give Will suggestions for the next 10 issue, because they get some other ideas, as we do as well, from smart audiences. Or add to what we've already talked about. You may know some things in science or some vice presidents, some independence movements, some things your body can do after you die that you would like to let us know about. 800-486-8655, 227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. Let's look at this. You have this incredible picture of the tallest building in the world, and nobody knows how tall it's going to be because it's not finished yet. It is huge.
It's amazing to look at, and or at least of the images that we see at this point. And you know what's interesting is I really don't know why developers are even trying to build the world's tallest building anymore, because it would only hold that title for, you know, say months, if that, because there are so many new projects underway that this huge building, the Burj Dubai, in Dubai, you know, will be the tallest building in the world, but I can't imagine that there won't be another one just, you know, the next year or so after that.
Yeah. Why do people want to build buildings that tall? Do you know?
Well, I'm sure there would be some theories that, you know, some appropriate for radio, some others that are not, maybe compensating for things. Some people may guess, but, you know, I really don't know why that people want to build. I guess that just building the greatest and the grandest of things. But obviously in Dubai, there's a real effort to draw attention to the country as sort of a crossroads for business there, because they definitely want, you know, as oil becomes less of a sense of profitability for them or a source of profitability for them, they want to find new ways to bring in business. And so they're trying to build not just this building, but if you've seen the images of Dubai and how much it's changing these days, it's pretty remarkable to see the buildings and the construction going on. I mean, more than half of the city is under construction at this point.
Really?
It's pretty amazing, everything that's going on there. And this building, the Burj Dubai, will rise somewhere around 2,300 feet. You know, as you said, we don't know exactly how tall, but the plans for the structure include a 175-room hotel, luxury spa, 56 elevators, and a spire that will be visible from 60 miles away. Now, when we last saw reports on this back in February of this year, they were working on the 159th floor, almost 2,000 feet in the air. So it's pretty amazing.
I think it would make you a little bit jittery, at least it would need to be.
I would think so, yeah. I can only imagine all of the engineering marvels that must go into it in order to keep this building relatively stable.
Right. Well, I'm not ready to book my ticket to Dubai.
Not yet.
What about this, the world's greenest skyscraper in Guangzhou, China?
That's pretty amazing. And we found this was an effort among a number of buildings, a number of new skyscrapers going up around the world. But this does appear to be the greenest, coming in 2010. It's certainly an energy-efficient high-rise, less than 2 years away from it being complete. But it will actually generate more energy than it consumes. And
really?
So by blending solar panels and wind turbines into the building structure. The self-generating power system will provide the building's heating, air conditioning, ventilation, and then for any additional cooling, it will use rainwater, which will be channeled through the chilled beams of the building. So, I mean, this to me is very neat to think about, just amazing to imagine a building that's able to produce more energy than it consumes.
Right, and good that it's happening in China.
Absolutely, yeah, where they're certainly facing quite a bit, not only of criticism, but very real attention given to them as the Olympics approach.
Right. Let's go to some phone calls. Mark is our first caller. Hi, Mark.
Hello, darling. Hey, back to that independence discussion we were having. Right here in Wisconsin, back in the 60s and 70s, there was talk about a new state called Superior, which would have been everything from Highway 29 north and including Upper Michigan.
Really?
Upper Michigan would have had to secede from Lower Michigan, of course.
Yeah.
And the president of that state was going to be a gentleman named Clark Hughes from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. He's now dead, but Clark thought that horse racing and gambling and everything could support a state of Superior, and it would make it an absolutely 52nd state, I guess.
And how much support was there for that?
Pardon?
How much support was there for that?
More bar talk than anything, I
right.
think. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Now, how large of an area? I don't know the area that well. How large of an area would that have
Well, that would be essentially from the nose of the Indian Head country over to Green Bay and then north to Lake Superior, all inclusive.
Okay.
So it would have been a big area.
That's pretty interesting. I've not heard of that, Mark.
Okay.
Thanks. Thanks for that. Probably would have drawn some tourists, too. Thanks, Mark, for the call. Paul is next from Duluth. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Well, you know, Superior can join Duluth if they want. But that's not what I've not heard that proposal either. I'm wondering if on your list, you're talking about architecture, if you've talked about the proposal to link by bridge Alaska to Russia using the Aleutian Islands as, kind of stepping stones, similar to the connection we have along the Florida Keys.
Mm-hmm. You know, we did see actually a number of plans for various bridges around the world, and part of the challenge with the 10 issue is that we have to limit it to 10, and we try to have, some nice diversity in there. But I did see a little bit about that. The bridge that we went with will be the longest suspension bridge in the world, which will be in the Indian Ocean. And so it's actually looking to be 18 miles long.
Oh, my.
It's pretty amazing seeing the structure.
But,
I'm sorry?
With a McDonald's at the halfway
through. Yeah, you joke, but you're probably right about that. So.
Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a long. I'm always amazed by the ability it takes to build certain things, and one of them is bridges. A suspension bridge that long to make it sturdy and to go so long a distance is quite a feat.
Yeah, and I can't. I don't see myself being brave enough to be one of the first people
right.
that goes across that bridge. I think I'll give it a little time.
So. Yeah. Yeah. What about this? We talked about the world's tallest building. What about in Moscow, the world's largest building?
That was also interesting to read about, because people are always trying to break records, but this will be in Russia, and it's meant as a symbol to show the nation's growing economic prowess, and it's a $4 billion project right now. It will be 1 square mile in size, filled with apartments, hotels, a school, a sports complex, an amusement park, and just about anything anyone else can imagine. I don't know why anyone would leave the place. But it will also be a green building, as we've mentioned with some of the others. Underneath the glass that struck, the structure of the building, there'll be a series of winter gardens that allow the interior to breathe, an extensive array of solar panels that will provide heat and reflect sunlight deep inside to the building. So it'll be interesting to see the building up. This one won't be up until about 2013.
And again, from China, the China Central Television headquarters, what are they doing?
this one is incredible, and it's really difficult to explain the way this building looks unless you look at it online. So I would encourage anybody to Google that, to look for the China Central Television headquarters. Supposed to be complete either later this year or sometime next year. As far as trying to explain it, some people call it a loop folded in space or a metal helmet for a robot or a misshapen square donut. I mean, it's very strange looking. And actually, it was breaking many of the building codes at the time. They let them get away with this. I don't know if it was because of the Olympics coming and trying to really showcase what's going on there in Beijing. But it will house about 10,000 employees, making it the second largest office building in the world, behind only the Pentagon. So, you know, it took 13 structural engineers gathered to figure out how to make this building safe because of its odd structure and look. But again, I would encourage anybody who has access to the internet to look that up, just to check out the structure of it.
Yet another one in China, the floating horizontal skyscraper.
This one is a little bit different. You know, the question we asked is, if you turn a skyscraper on its side, is it still a skyscraper? But Stephen Hole, who was the architect behind the building, claims that it would be, and it's nearly as long as the Empire State Building is tall. And so, you know, the structure is very interesting because the building appears to hover above ground. And so to achieve this, they built in these kind of floating Tetris-like pieces that hold the building up. And it will allow for these kind of beautiful walkways and green parks below it. You can imagine a huge space that's under there, which will give people an opportunity to go outside and enjoy, their surroundings without, you know, the hot sun or anything beating down on them.
Yeah. The first hotel in space?
That is part of the plan. Believe it or not, coming in 2012, I do have some of my doubts about this. They've already developed two prototypes, the Genesis 1 and the Genesis 2, which are currently orbiting the globe right now. But the follow-up to that, tentatively named Sundancer, is scheduled to be ready, as I mentioned, in 2012. You know, you say hotel, but it will only house up to about 15 guests who can stay for a week, where they'll enjoy zero gravity and unobstructed stargazing and all of the wonders of being out in space. So it will be very interesting to see how this one develops. I wouldn't imagine that a night in the Sundancer would be all that cheap, though.
Right. I don't know about this thing about enjoying zero gravity. Why is it so great? Do you know?
You know? I would like to experience it just to see it once, at least once. But yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure that it'd be worth whatever this will cost to get up there.
Yeah. Do you have any idea how much it will cost, Will?
I don't, although the main people behind this right now do have a vision for a space hotel that will make for an affordable vacation one day. I can't imagine that would happen anytime in the next couple of decades, but that is one of their goals, to provide this for just about anyone.
More phone calls in a moment. Will Pearson is our guest this hour. He is co-founder and editor of Mental Floss Magazine, and their May-June issue is the annual 10 issue. They're putting the spotlight on 10 American sports heroes you won't find on a Wheaties box, 10 things your body can do after you die, 10 modern-day independence movements, 10 architectural masterpieces, 10 ruthless rock managers, 10 U.S. vice presidents, 10 not-so-bright ideas in science, and the 10 list goes on. We welcome your phone calls if you'd like to add to those areas we've already discussed, or have suggestions for other 10 lists. That would be fine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee number is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And our email address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Will Pearson, co-founder and editor of Mental Floss Magazine. Join us if you'd like. Our number, 800-486-8655. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. 10 things your body can do after you die. One is get married. How do you do that?
That's true. You know, death is no obstacle when it comes to love in China, and that's because ghost marriage, which is the practice of setting up deceased relatives with suitable spouses, either dead or alive, is still an option. You know, this first appeared over 2,000 years ago, so it's definitely not something new. You know, most of the time this served a religious function by making the deceased happier in the afterlife. And so today the goal is often to give a deceased bachelor a wife, preferably one who has been recently laid to rest. So it was an interesting practice to read about. Unfortunately, because of the ratio of females to males there, or males to females, it's more difficult many times if a male dies to arrange for this marriage in the afterlife. And so, unfortunately, it has led to many crimes and reported cases of rural men killing prostitutes or housekeepers and mentally ill women in order to sell their bodies as ghost wives. This was reported on in the Washington Post not too long ago. So it's a very strange practice, but it does exist.
Very strange practice. Now, here's a unique idea. Starting in 1997, a Swedish city used local crematoriums to supply 10% of the heat for its homes.
I know it sounds odd, but it's actually pretty interesting to read about. You know, cremating the body uses up a lot of energy and a lot of non-renewable resources at that. And so, as you mentioned, a number of European crematoriums have tried to figure out a way to replace these conventional boilers by harnessing the heat that's produced by these fires. And, you know, as you said, they supply up to 10% of the heat for the homes in this small Swedish town that has started using this technology.
Yeah. What in the world prompted you to think about this, 10 things your body can do after you die?
It's one of our former editors, actually, who still writes for us pretty regularly. I guess because she'd been on the staff, she was just warped enough to be able to come up with an idea like this. But it was, we didn't know what to think about it. You know, we try not to publish too many articles that are, you know, terribly morbid or anything like that. But something about this, when we started reading the information that she was presenting to us, it was just so fascinating that we thought, well, we really need to do this.
Yeah. Tour the Globe is a scandalous work of art. It's been in Milwaukee recently.
Yeah, with the Body World exhibit, right. Or was it one of the others?
It was, yes, the Body World exhibitors.
Yeah, it is. It's certainly become controversial because there are others that are involved in this. Now, the Body World's one has been able to show that their bodies were donated voluntarily to the organization. But there have been some others where they've come under much more extensive criticism and just scrutiny over their practices, because many of these unclaimed bodies, they believe, are from executed political prisoners that would be touring the globe. And so obviously that would be problematic and controversial. But I haven't had an opportunity to go see one of these exhibits, but from what I understand, it is disturbing, but at the same time pretty amazing to look
yes.
at.
Yeah, I saw the one here. It is. It is. You leave a little bit queasy, but it is fascinating to look at the exhibit. Let's look at some sports here for a while. I think these guys, I've always thought this is kind of a weird sport. Sumo wrestling.
Sumo wrestling is a bit of a strange sport, and as you probably know there, I mean, to become a grand champion is almost reaching the level of a deity there, but only 69 men throughout history have claimed the title of Yokozuna, which is a grand champion there. And no foreigner had ever held the honor until Hawaii's Chad Rowan claimed the honor there not too long ago, or actually in the 1990s. And so it was interesting to read about this, and, you know, to gain that status from a foreign territory was pretty amazing. So he did receive one of the honors from us as 10 American sports heroes you won't find on a Wheaties box. So.
We have an email from Paul from Glendale who wondered if Hank Aaron was one of those great sports heroes who was not featured on the Wheaties box.
You know, that would be interesting. I mean, part of our effort was to go after heroes from sports that you might not have heard of, but I can't actually verify right now whether Hank Aaron has ever been or was ever on a Wheaties box.
Somebody will know in our audience. Let us know if Hank Aaron was on a Wheaties box. I didn't even know there was such a thing as elephant polo.
Yeah. You know, we had been looking at a number of pictures from this not too long ago. That's part of the fun in doing the research, you know, for articles like this, is in trying to find the images. And it's pretty amazing to look at. But, you know, Thailand celebrates the sport, and then the tournaments are often there. And you know, teams are put together from all over the world, believe it or not. And actually, it was pretty funny because someone posted an ad on Craigslist looking for teammates in Washington, D.C., and amazingly, people responded. And so they tried to put together a team to go over to play. And actually, they placed second in a competition in Sri Lanka. So it's pretty funny. I can't imagine there are many elephant polo facilities around. They must have been born with a natural ability to play elephant polo.
And then there's Sally Hale, who disguised herself so she could play polo.
And that's always such a great story when, you know, people, undeterred by any of those obstacles, decided to play. And as you mentioned, she received her, she did decide to play, but she received her first horse at the age of 3 and was determined to play polo, even though Southern California's thriving 1950s polo scene didn't allow women to play. And so she decided to disguise herself as a man, and before each tournament she would don a baggy shirt, stuff her hair under her helmet, and draw a mustache on with mascara. So clearly somebody wasn't studying all that close, but she played under the name A. Jones and competed very ferociously, and many people complimented on her style, and so she played for years.
Oh, you have to tell the story of the Milwaukee Athletic Club team. Nobody was from Milwaukee.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's one of those things in the sport of tug of war, which was actually an Olympic sporting event from 1900 to 1920. And traditionally, the best teams came from Scandinavia and Great Britain, where the sport still enjoys a strong following. But one American squad managed to grab hold in the 1904 St. Louis games, the Pullers of the Milwaukee Athletic Club. And it's pretty interesting to see that, you know, this come together. But there was a slight snag. No one on the team was actually from Milwaukee, as you mentioned. Instead, the athletes were ringers that the clubs had supposedly recruited from Chicago. And although the undefeated teams filed a grievance, the Olympic officials rejected the protest, and the so-called men from Milwaukee got to walk away with both their medals and their honor.
Soccer. There's a sport that's big everywhere in the world except in the United States, and it is here among young people, but it's not the beautiful game that everybody else thinks that it is here. John Harkes?
It is, and it's interesting to see that it's a sport that's certainly growing in popularity here in the States, and especially as, you know, many of the English athletes and others from Europe have come over to play. But John Harkes grew up in Virginia and wanted to play soccer, moved over to the UK to play for some time, and had a difficult time gaining respect over there for some time. But after playing so well, he did earn their respect. So I think this is one of those guys that probably should have ended up on a Wheaties box, but has not at this point. He's returned to the United States to play here for a number of years as well.
Do they still put sports heroes on Wheaties boxes? Is there still Wheaties?
I believe, you know, that's the same question that I ask when we do this. I believe there are still Wheaties, and I believe they do still put the sports stars on there. But I have to be honest, it's been many years since I've eaten a box of Wheaties.
I don't know if I ever have. Yeah, kind of makes me want to try some
Wheaties.
Yeah,
maybe we'd be better athletes. It'd be a different conversation
right.
If we had.
That's absolutely right. No, we'd be the forgotten heroes.
Yeah,
then we
right.
would be in your magazine, right? 10 Ruthless Rock Managers. Number one is the Kingmaker, Colonel Tom Parker.
That's right. You know, Elvis, one of the facts that I learned about this and didn't know before is that Elvis Presley never performed overseas. And the reason was is because his manager, Tom Parker, said that he shouldn't. Now, he had a number of excuses for this. He blamed security issues and the hassles of touring internationally. But the truth was that the colonel was an illegal alien. And so if he left the country, he risked being exposed and therefore barred reentry. So.
Oh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Tell me about the ones that you find most interesting on this list, some of these rock managers.
Well, some of the stories of them and their different, you know, methods of managing are pretty interesting. Some by fear, one known as the Al Capone of pop, Don Arden, once had one of his henchmen dangle a fellow manager, Robert Stigwood, out of the fourth floor window, all because he suspected Stigwood was trying to steal one of his bands. And so, you know, it's interesting to read kind of like the mafia-like tactics of many of these. And the other was just how the economics of management goes over the years. You know, you read about somebody like David Bowie, and you assume that he just had been filthy rich from the beginning because of his success, but really so much of that rides on the deal that they signed with their manager. His manager, Tony DeFreeze, had actually signed such a great deal with him that he was taking more than half of his earnings, and even though he was largely responsible for the publicity buzz that was built around David Bowie, it was very difficult for David Bowie to actually make anything out of this. And one of his comments was that he slaved for nothing and finally got out of the arrangement. But, you know, it was interesting to read about this, of everything from, you know, these older guys in rock to Joe Simpson, who's Jessica Simpson's father. And you see much more of that these days as you see these teen pop stars coming along and their parent managers. I can't imagine what those relationships must be like, but interesting stories to read, certainly.
You wonder how somebody trains for that kind of job, don't you?
I can't imagine. I know that it must take some sort of built-in kind of ruthlessness about them in order to be able to pull it off, but certainly not a job that I would aspire to have.
No, I wouldn't either. This is not in the 10 category, but there are some interesting little tidbits at the front of the magazine. Some of these words, if you can go to that part of the magazine, the words that have come from war, how violence increases our vocabulary. It's fascinating to know where words came from, but I had no idea that some of these words came from war.
That's true. Yeah, you never expect it. We love to do word origins, and we find many of our readers are always asking about, you know, what's the origin of this word or that word, and to read about words like undermine, which you wouldn't necessarily suspect came from a war origin, but dates back to the 14th century and once was a military term for literally digging a secret passage under a building in order to sneak up on the enemy. And of course, this term kind of evolved over time to be used in the way that it is today.
Fleabag.
Fleabag started back in the 1830s and was a soldier's bed. And so now this word is frequently used in reference to hotels, but it's another one of those that had a very different meaning at first, but kind of evolved over time to find a very new one.
Mm-hmm. Also, basket case. This is a bizarre story.
This was an interesting, you know, today a basket case is simply, I guess, a neurotic person, but back during World War One, it meant a living soldier who had lost all of his limbs and was brought home in a basket.
Oh,
and so that was a difficult image there, but at the same time, you can see how this could eventually evolve into this meaning. But, you know, we're studying many of the current terms that are out there, and just a few that we mentioned in the magazine. One is the word FOBIT, which is combines two terms. One is FOB, which is forward operating base, and then the word HOBBIT. And so the word is a very derogatory term for those soldiers who stay too close to the base and enjoy their three meals and all of the other, I don't know if you should say luxuries, but certainly luxuries compared to what these soldiers on the front lines are experiencing.
Interesting. corporate logos, excuse me. Tell the story. We have enough time for the Starbucks story.
Okay, yeah. You know, today the Starbucks logo is far tamer than it originally was back in 1971. There's a mermaid, if you can imagine, the Starbucks logo now, which included bare breasts, an exposed navel, and two nails. But the image had come from an old Norse woodcut and tied in nicely with the original seafaring theme of the coffee shop, which is named after the first mate in Moby Dick. But it was in 1987 when Howard Schultz bought the rights to the chain. He decided to give the mermaid a more contemporary look. He covered her breasts with hair, and a few years later hid her navel as well. But you can still see the original. If you go to the Starbucks in Seattle's Pike's Place, it still proudly displays the mermaid in all of her belly button glory, as we say in the magazine.
Thank you so much for being with us, Will. It was great
fun.
Thank
you, Kathleen.
Thanks.
I always enjoy it. Take care.
Thanks. You too. Thanks for the magazine, too, which is really a fun one, and it's got a lot of interesting history in it as well. Will Pearson is co-founder and editor of Mental Floss magazine. Feel Smart Again, where knowledge junkies get their fix, and we're talking about their May-June issue, which is the annual 10 issue. 10 not-so-bright ideas in science, the next 10 wonders of the world, 10 sports heroes who are neglected by Wheaties, 10 vice presidents actually worth knowing, 10 things your body can do after you die, and the list goes on. So Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We do want to tell you that it's getting very close to the last day. Is it today or tomorrow? Tomorrow is the last day for you to sign up for all of the activities surrounding the appearance by Ira Flatow, host of Talk of the Nation Science Friday. He's coming to Milwaukee on May 16 for a live national broadcast of his program. And you can join us at the Milwaukee Public Museum May 16 from 1 to 3 for the show and stay for a reception to meet Ira and members of the Science Friday team. Tickets are $20 and include admission to the museum, the radio broadcast, and a reception with refreshments, we might add. Later that day, a VIP dinner at Mater's German Restaurant in downtown Milwaukee with Ira Flatow and our own WPR hosts. Joy will be there. Ben, I'll be there. And tickets for the buffet dinner are $50 each. And on Thursday, May 15, we're teaming up with Discovery World for their family night activities, including museum tours, and they'll have special demonstrations. And Ira Flatow will give a demonstration entitled Catalysts of Creativity, from Movie Stars to Michael Jackson. Tickets are $15 for adults and $10 for children up to 17. If you'd like to get tickets, please call 414-227-2047. That's 414-227-2047. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and John Treader, and we'll be with you tomorrow.